Be making your way to Revelation chapter 1. That's where we'll be working tonight in Revelation chapter 1. Before we jump into that, it occurred to me that this weekend is the women's weekend.
Next weekend, this coming weekend.
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I was finding Revelation 1.
Know,
I'm sorry.
It's hard to find. It's in the back. And it occurred to me that that means you're going to be babysitting for four this weekend.
Not exactly. Remember?
And I guess I just call it a free weekend. So I don't have to keep up with the kids.
What a plug for Women's Weekend.
Hey, that's going to be a great study.
It is.
And
it
so I want to encourage our ladies to carve out your time this Saturday. To attend that event. That's going to be Friday night and Saturday. Sign-up sheet on the table in the back if you're planning to come. And I think you'll really, really profit. Really interesting approach to go back to those Old Testament feasts and then tie them into life. So a lot of value spending time looking at that.
It's a good idea. It'll be a good weekend.
Tonight we're going to work in Revelation chapter 1. And as we've done each Sunday night, we try to spend a little time talking about the why we chose this one. And that's actually complicated because there are a lot of reasons that we thought it would be valuable to look at this one. First of all, most obvious, it is the book is difficult, right? I think some would consider it among the most difficult in the Bible.
And therefore controversial and avoided.
So you just took care of the introduction. That's what I was going to lead up to with all those other points.
But do elaborate.
Do elaborate. The first couple of chapters aren't hard, right? Which is why if anybody knows anything about Revelation, they typically know, well, there's that stuff about the churches in chapters two and three. But then you get beyond that and you get into these battles and beasts and all the blood and the carnage that's left behind and...
Well, then we just go to the end. We do it like Job, right? I mean, we know the very beginning and we know the very end, chapters 21 and 22, where it's very, you know, it's all heaven. And everything in between is flyover country.
A flyover. You know, it wouldn't matter so much if this was like pictures in a gallery, right? So if you're in an art gallery and you're, I'm hypothetically speaking because I don't think I've ever been in an art gallery. But if you were and you're wandering around looking at the pictures and you go past some Picasso that just looks like a mess of paint on a canvas, right? You know, you just pass on by. And you have to worry about that and look for something that's got, like, trees that look like trees and stuff like that. You make some sense out of. The problem with Revelation is that it is a revelation, which means it's supposed to be revealing something. And so we can't just say, wow, that's chapter 13. That's really bizarre. I think I'll move on to something else because chapter 14 is going to be more of the same.
Well, and it's meant to be difficult in this sense. It is a revelation. It is an unveiling of things that aren't otherwise obvious. Otherwise, God wouldn't have to be showing and unraveling all of this for John, the churches, and us.
So if I've got to find the message in the middle of all this bizarre imagery, that then becomes a challenge. And so the second thing you said, it is, I think, a neglected book. I've heard it described as the turn-back book in the Bible. You know what that means, right? That in a lot of adult auditorium classes, they would start at Matthew, and their Bible class program is, well, let's go through the whole Bible. Matthew to Jude, anyway. And when you get done with Jude, you turn back and go back to Matthew because nobody wants to mess with Revelation. I will tell you, I have taught Revelation more than any other book of the Bible, and it was largely because nobody else wanted to teach it. If it was going to get taught, I wound up having to teach the class, right?
Right.
And there are consequences to neglecting it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it is, in one sense, it's the book that ties the Bible together. In fact, one of the things that, if you're not in our Wednesday night class lately, I've been trying to show how all these different great themes of the Bible ultimately come together at the end in Revelation. And so, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's an important book because it really is literally God's last word to the human race before he goes silent until the second coming of Jesus. And that ought to kind of, you know, make us all the more interested in what God's final word is.
Well, and if it's a revelation, there was something that we were supposed to see, something we're supposed to know. The Holy Spirit wanted this preserved for all time and all people. And so whatever was supposed to be here for us, we don't get it if we turn back. But the other part of that problem is, I think when we do that, we leave the book to the speculators.
Right.
In fact, I think if anybody knows anything about Revelation out in the broader world, it's a consequence of what the speculators have done with the book, which brings us to the third reason we need to talk about that, because the book is so misused.
Abused, even.
Fair to say. Misused and abused. Some of us are old enough to remember the late great Planet Earth. Remember that? Raise your hand.
Hal Lindsey.
Wow, there's a bunch of you that didn't raise your hand. You're making me feel really old. Y'all remember the late great Planet Earth, right? Sold millions of copies, yes. No one under the age of about 35 raised their hand. Because the truth is, you don't hear very much about that kind of stuff anymore. The speculation about how Revelation is this roadmap to what's happening in, well, what was with Russia.
Now, well, I was about to say, it was the Cold War.
It was, yeah, exactly. And how all of that was going to usher in the end of the world. And if you could just figure out this book, you'd sort of get the code for figuring out the end and when it's coming.
Well, especially at the end of the Cold War. I mean, there were, you know, all these, you know, televangelists who were trying to set dates on the end based on Bible code speculation out of Revelation. And that's part of what happens is the imagery is, if we're not familiar with where it comes from and where how it was first used, it's really easy to abuse it and speculate and you know, with no constraints, with no limits on the meaning people can impose upon the book.
So I grew up with a lot of teaching when it came to Revelation, about what the book doesn't mean.
Right.
Can y'all relate to that? I heard a lot of lessons about, you know, like Revelation 20 is not the proof text for a 1,000-year reign on earth.
Right.
But sometimes what we miss along the way, not that that's unimportant.
Right.
But we miss what is more important.
Right.
And that is, well, okay, that's not what it's about. But what is it about? What is the message? What is it saying to us?
And it was meant to be, it really was meant to be understood, because you had suffering Christians in real trouble there. And this was God's message to them. And he expected them to be able to be encouraged into endurance and even hope on the basis of what this odd to us book says.
And so, yeah, I think that's really important, because one of the points Jeff and I'll make tonight is that more and more as our world changes, I think the message of this book becomes relevant to us. And if we don't get it, I think we're missing on the comfort and the hope that it is meant to supply for disciples passing through cultural circumstances that feel comfortless and hopeless.
Right.
And so that idea of it being a revealing, whatever it's saying about those things, we miss the value, the benefit in it, because all we really know is what it doesn't mean and not what the message
right.
is.
And I think it enables holiness too, David, in the sense that it unmasks and it unveils, it reveals the sinister character of the world and who is at work in the world in ways that we often forget in our day-to-day life when we're comfortable. And so realizing this world really is not our home, and there really is a dragon, a lion, and Peter out there, trying to devour us, who actively wants to make war against us.
You know? Well, so I think the challenge we face is trying to find the message and the hope that it has for us, and to do that by wading through the rather bizarre imagery that is the book. And I think the reason we chose Revelation 1 is because right here in this first chapter, I think there are some things that help us with that. And right. so we've called these the keys for unlocking the mystery. Sometimes I think that because we don't really understand how to work the book.
Right.
We don't really get what the message is. I actually don't think this is the hardest book in the Bible, folks. And I think it's just about getting initiated to how it works. And when you figure that out, it becomes a whole lot easier.
That's accessible. One
of the reasons I love teaching it to kids, because for kids, it's like, it's about, you get about a month into class and all of a sudden the light bulb comes on. And the kids are like, wow, Revelation, isn't that hard?
No.
It's a really cool book.
No.
And figure out what it is. And so I really think if we could get sort of that, the key to unlock it for us.
Right.
It would make a whole lot more sense.
Right.
And some of that is right here in chapter 1. So we thought we'd work on that a little bit tonight, work on a better understanding of this book. Let us give you three keys that I think you at least begin to see in chapter 1 that will help you figure out this book. Starting with this. to get revelation, you need to understand that it has a set. So when I put that word up there, you're laughing, that worries me. Think about a play, right? Been to see a play? And when they open the curtain for the first act, someone has got on the stage before the actors, and most of the time there's a set there.
Right.
And the set is useful. Have you thought about that? They will put some things there that help you get in your mind what this thing is all about.
Right.
So maybe the play is going to open with a couple taking a romantic walk out on a pier. And so before there are any actors or any dialogue, maybe they'll have a background of a seascape, and they'll have a wooden pier that someone constructed and some sand that was put on the floor. So before there's any dialogue or any action taking place, you can kind of see what's going to be about. You understand? Has a set to it. So to get revelation, I think one of the things to understand is that the book has a setting.
Right.
When John writes this, the people who receive this letter are going through something. They're dealing with some stuff. There's a setting going on in their lives that
right.
when you understand that, it sort of helps you begin to piece together what the book is trying to say.
Right. And in particular, you know, we're talking about exile and persecution. John admits at the very beginning of the chapter that he is in exile on Patmos, and he's writing to Christians who are being persecuted in various ways. And in the imagery that comes about, it's going to be saints who are persecuted within the context of the vision. And so it's from John's own self-revelation to the original recipients of the letter, to the vision that they are told about, it's persecution all the way down.
So that's why I think verse 9 in chapter 1 is particularly important. If I could invite you to look carefully at that verse tonight, because you're right. John says, I, John, your brother, and then I like this language, your brother and fellow partaker. Mm-hmm. So just pause over those two words for a minute. What do they say to you? Whatever's going on, John says, I'm in that too. I'm going through this. I'm your fellow partaker, right?
Right.
Fellow partaker of what? Well, fellow partaker in the tribulation and kingdom and perseverance which are in Jesus. And so we could just take off and preach a sermon there, right?
Right, there's your 3 points.
That's exactly right. 3 quick points. Because he starts with this tribulation. So what does that tell us?
They're in trouble.
Something's going on.
Yeah.
And it involves kingdom people.
Right.
Trouble for kingdom people. And then this, the word perseverance made me think about the very end of your sermons this morning. where we're called on to press on.
Right,
push through. And evidently these people are having to push through
right.
some kind of trouble that John shares with them. And then the last thing, which are in Jesus, calls to mind that whatever this is, it has to do with their walk. It has to do with
right.
their relationship with Christ.
And that third word, endurance, is important. Let's underscore that. That's one of the ultimate applications of the book. Even when you know what's going on, and God says it's hard and it may get harder. What's the point? Why do I know this? Know that because God knows, God's still in control, I have to endure, persevere anyways.
So I think it's critical as John launches us into this book not to miss that right at the very outset of this, he says kingdom citizens are going through something right now that requires us to persevere. Now, the interesting thing is, as you press on in the book, he really starts to develop that idea. So you get into chapter 2. We'll skip ahead a little. Is that okay? We won't limit ourselves in chapter 1. I thought about the letter to Smyrna. So this is chapter 2, verse 9. Watch the way this idea of trouble gets developed. He says to this church, I know your tribulation. There's our word again. And your poverty, but you are rich. And the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but of synagogue of Satan. And there it is in verse 10. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. So we get an expansion in two on the problem.
Right.
Here's this church going through a terrible fiery ordeal that in this case we know involves imprisonment. Some are going to go to jail and be locked up because of their faith.
Right. And in some other contexts, even die. I mean, Antipas will be named as the faithful martyr who dies.
Yeah, so I thought about that too. If you jump ahead a little bit beyond that to chapter 6. Mm-hmm. And
which is now in the vision.
Yes, now you're getting wrapped in the visions. And verses 9 through 11 have those disciples, the souls of the disciples under the altar whose blood cries for justice. How long are you going to let these people kill us before you do something about that?
And especially at that point in the book, David, that's really the question that drives the book. I mean, really, the thing about suffering that drives us nuts is, and the ancients were a little different than us today, is why is God letting this happen if we are kingdom people?
Right.
And so, you know, as the vision, we're just barely in the vision in chapter 6. How long, O Lord? And that's really the question in one sense that drives the rest of the book. God's giving an answer, not so much about how long. He doesn't ever answer how long, but he answers with a clear vision of my control and the certain outcome that I'll give victory to my people.
So I even thought about the way you could follow that thread in the tapestry all the way to chapter 13, mm-hmm. where we see those beasts, the one who rises out of the sea and the one who rises out of the earth. Notice in verse 7, this is 13:7, it was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. So again, all the way through this book, we trace this conflict, this battle that's going on that involves the oppression of God's people.
Right.
And so from the beginning, we have this setting. This is what's going on. This is what the story is about.
Well, right. I mean, part of what the book is revealing to people on earth is, to use John's words in chapter 12, there's war in heaven, that Satan and his demons are at war with God, and we're caught up in that. And so that's part of what's being revealed. And so that's why we're suffering on earth in our churches, in our congregations, in our lives.
Now, One of the distractions, I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, but one of the distractions I think we are tempted into when we study the book is to try to nail down the exact historical circumstances that the book is describing.
Right.
And so the whole controversy about the date, right? So no good class on Revelation does it begin without at least one whole class devoted to the date. Even among our brethren, we have the dating controversy. Are you an early dater or a late dater, right?
Right.
And so there is that temptation to want to know the exact historical setting. And so I know you're going to agree about this since we already talked about it. Jeff and I together will this is me throwing both of us under the bus together.
Yeah, usually just throw me under the bus.
Yeah, I'll join you tonight. Both of us, I think, would say, I'm not sure that's that important.
Right.
Not that it's completely unimportant. Probably doesn't deserve the attention that we give to it.
And is not going to drive the application of the book to us today in any really substantive, meaningful way, whether it was written in the 60s or the 90s, whether it was about Jerusalem or about Rome. The ultimate application of these images, these visions, these ideas is not really going to change for people in the 21st century, regardless of those particular points.
It isn't because I don't have some opinions about that. I read this, and knowing a little about the history, I know that my mind tends to go to a certain time period.
Oh, it's clearly one.
Yeah, but here's the reason we don't think that's especially important. Everybody battles a dragon, folks. So chapter 12, in my judgment, is just one of the really key chapters in the book.
Yeah.
Because we find out who the real enemy is. The real enemy is the dragon, the great red dragon, who is identified for us in chapter 12. John says it's Satan. It's the devil. And every generation, the war in Revelation is fought. It may look a little different from generation to generation, but all of us are going to do battle with this adversary.
Right.
And I think that's why there may be this temptation. Y'all notice that men in every age seem to find Revelation. or to believe that Revelation is applying to their time.
The crisis of their age.
Yeah,
of
yeah,
their
yeah time. Y'all realize that, that back during the 40s, right? What was happening in the 40s? World War II. So guess who the beast was? Germany and Hitler. And there was even, someone even came up with a system where 666 equaled the spelling of Hitler. And found a way to do that.
See, I remember in the 80s when 666 was Ronald Reagan, because Ronald Wilson Reagan, six letters in each of those names. Clearly, clearly, Reagan was the mark of the beast.
Well, as a child of the 80s, I remember, the beast being Russia.
Well, sure.
And then Russia went away, and you think, well, what do we do now?
But Reagan was the guy who was going to lead us to a nuclear holocaust against the Russians. Don't you remember that?
I'm not sure what he wants me to say right now. I'm thinking this may be one of those moments where the wise man says, say nothing. Yes, I do remember that. I do remember.
But the point is, we all, through the ages, we read our moment into this book.
And I think there's a reason for that.
Right.
Because at the core, the same battle's being waged in every generation. Does that make sense?
Well, and we can even take it back a step. You realize a lot of these images that Revelation uses are from the Old Testament. And so what's fascinating is some of the images that that John is using, that Christ is giving to John, about whether it's Rome or Jerusalem, but clearly it's Rome, I'm joking. No, are from the Old Testament when Babylon was the beast. You see how
right.
this works?
Yeah.
Because the Jews in the age of Babylon, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had to deal with the beast, the harlot, that was Babylon. And now here we come right. to Revelation 18. And that world, the power of that age was the harlot. Because folks, in a sense, what the Bible is telling us is it's always Babylon out there.
Yeah.
Whatever age you live in, whatever empire, whatever city. And so that's why the images are reusable. Because in every age, there is some source of political evil, some source of religious evil, some source of pressure, cultural, if not direct persecution, on the people of God in every age.
And the immorality.
The
political power, the false religion,
right.
and the immorality, the prostitute later in the
right.
book. And so I think the key to remember in wrestling with figuring out the message of the book is to focus more on what the book is saying than when, John may have had in mind as he describes
right.
the events.
That the dynamic and the struggle never change, and that it's Satan working through whatever, period of history you're living in, whatever names, countries, of groups, organizations, cultural issues. It's always the beast. It's always the dragon working against you.
Someone asks, so you're saying that Revelation was written to comfort people in those days that were going through persecution?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and?
Well, right. And by extension, this is a way to read history in any time or place, not about because it's foretelling the exact end of the world the way people wanted to use it, but it's a way of saying this is the struggle of every generation in the church. Let me give one other quick example of that from chapter 11. Watch how this works. In Revelation chapter 11, we won't worry about who the two witnesses are, but they die. They do their work for God, and they die in Revelation chapter 11. But look at what John does in Revelation 11 and verse 8. And the dead bodies of the two witnesses for God, the two, symbolically, two people who stood up, not two literal people, I think it was just people who stand up for God and tell the truth of their age. Their bodies, the world kills them. Their bodies lie in the street of the great city, which is called ESV says symbolically, we won't worry about what a better translation is about that tonight, but notice, the great city which is symbolically called Sodom and Egypt and where their Lord was crucified. Well, wait a second, which is it? That's the point. Because in every era, in the first century, Jerusalem killed Jesus and James the Apostle and Stephen and so forth. By the way, Rome would kill Paul and Peter. And before that, Sodom is harassing Lot. And before that, you had Babylon putting to death or trying to put to death Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's always the same issue. The city of man always wants to kill the people of God in some way.
So let's put a bow on that and move on to some other things to think about. And so let me summarize it by saying this. What we need to do when we work with this book, before we start paying attention to the dialogue, what the actors are saying in the vision, get the scene first. What's going on? What's happening in the lives of the people who are the audience of this book? And how does that influence then how we understand the message? Need to ponder that. So second key in chapter 1, go back to chapter 1 if you will, that I think helps us understand the book is to recognize that Revelation has a unique style. I probably don't even need to say that, right? I think the thing that grabs us about the book and most troubles us about the book is that it is clearly different than anything else. It doesn't read like Acts, right? So, you know, if we go back to Acts, for example, I thought about there at the end of Acts 8 when Stephen is being stoned. And it said, look at verse 54, Acts 7, verse 54. Now, when they heard this, they were cut to the quick. And they began gnashing their teeth at him. And then verse 57, they cried with a loud voice and covered their ears and rushed upon him with one impulse. They drive him from the city. And in verse 59 says they went on stoning Stephen as he called on the Lord. And so we don't ever read that and say, wow, I don't really understand what's going on there. That's hard to figure out. But now hold that in your brain and jump back to Revelation 13. Look in Revelation, back up, chapter 12 is what I wanted. Chapter 12 and verse 17, where John writes, so the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Now, I think both of those two passages are describing the same thing. But we read that one at the end of chapter 12, and we think, I don't have any idea what's going on here.
Right.
Read the one in Acts 7, and that was not so hard to figure out.
Right.
And so the style is different. If you look at chapter 1, John really tells us, though, that's going to be that way, right? So in chapter 1 and verse 1 of Revelation, notice how he begins. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must soon take place. And he sent and, what's the next word in your reading?
Signified.
Yeah, mine is communicated with a marginal reference that says signified. Sent and signified it by his angel to his bondservant John. I paused over that word because that word can carry the significance of communicating by signs.
Correct. Right? I mean, that's very much the idea.
So John is saying, I'm gonna use symbols to communicate my message.
Right.
And if there's any doubt that that's the meaning, when you press on through the first chapter, you see that. Because you don't get out of chapter 1 without a vision. So starting in verse 12, he turns to see the voice speaking with him, and he sees seven golden lampstands. And then there's a whole lot more to that vision when you read on through. But notice when you get to verse 20 of chapter 1, we're told that the seven lampstands are
the seven churches.
The seven churches. So right away, he says, I'm using symbolism. These churches that I'm going to talk to in the letter are symbolized by this lampstand.
Right.
So symbolism is going to be the way the story is told.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because that's literally the word there is the same one he uses in the Gospels often for wanting people to see the symbolic significance of Jesus' miracles. John's Gospel never calls them miracles. They call them signs. He wants you to see beneath the surface to the greater significance. He didn't just give people food when he multiplied the loaves and fishes. It signified something. It meant something more than what it looks like. That's the nature of a sign, right? The sign is not the thing itself. The sign is signifying, showing you something underneath it. And that's what this whole book is about. He's told us in that word choice, even if our English translations kind of, you know, like you said, you got a footnote or something there, kind of water it down. John literally says this is a book of signs, symbols. And maybe symbols is better because signs has that religious idea of, you know,
right,
God gave me a sign. It is a book of symbols.
So let's talk a little bit about working with the symbols, because I think one of the things that has tripped me up over the years is my propensity to want to identify every detail of the symbol.
Which is a mistake.
Yeah. So when you look at the vision, you're thinking, oh, well, what does that, sort of like this. Imagine looking at the parable of the Good Samaritan and saying, remember, the Good Samaritan puts the man on his donkey?
Right.
I wonder what the deeper spiritual significance of the donkey is. You ever wondered about that? I can honestly tell you that I have never wondered about that. I assume the donkey is just a donkey that carried the guy to where he wanted to him, where he wanted to keep him. And he's just scenery. I remember I said that in a Bible class one time. Somebody was asking me about to the angel of the church at Ephesus, right? The guy says, what's the angel? I said, well, I don't know. All the churches have an angel. I know, but what does he symbolize? I said, I don't know. You know, the book's got angels everywhere. You know, the church just has an angel. Yeah, but what's his deeper spiritual significance? And I said, maybe he's just the angel of the church. And he said, no, that can't be that. There's got to be more to that. So it is that propensity I think we have. We deal this book to say all the pieces of the vision need to have some kind of grand, deeper spiritual significance to them.
But as a sidebar, David, right there, because that's an important point. I mean, part of this is also, a lot of us have been through bad English classes in school, right, where our English teachers taught us or tempted us to every detail, and a story has meaning when it doesn't. I remember a story of an English professor I knew back at Baylor who tells a great story about when he was in a class, when he was a student with an author, and somebody's trying to be real smart, raises his hand and asks the author a question about her story. Why, you know, what's the symbol, what's the significance of the man's black hat? And she says, the meaning of the black hat is to cover the man's head. Yeah. I mean, just, we have been trained.
Sometimes that's what it is.
Yeah, it's that simple. Yeah. He has a hat to wear it. There's no symbolic significance to it beyond that.
So when I teach a revelation to kids, one of the things I make them do, I put a poster on the wall and I make them read the vision and draw it. So it's pretty cool. They go to Bible class, get to write on the walls. That's what they've always wanted to do anyway. And so they have to draw the vision. And when they get done, what I'll say to them is, what does that say to you? And sometimes I think if you read chapter 13, that awful beast that rises up out of the sea and oppresses the people of God, if you could read that and say, that's a picture of an awful beast that's rising up out of the sea and oppressing the people of God, you've got the gist of it. So sometimes it's healthy just to step back and take in the whole picture. Sometimes the details have significance.
Right.
There's some Old Testament figures that weave their way into the book. You don't have to have all that figured out. Figure out Revelation, though. Get the big picture. Understand with the basic point of the, like we do with the parable. What's the point of the parable of the Good Samaritan? Take care of your neighbor. Right?
Right.
The man who is in need is the one who is your neighbor. Take care of him. And if we can do that with Revelation, do that with these visions, I think sometimes that makes the study a whole lot easier.
Well, and again, the point is clear. You face a terrible beast. You can't beat him, but someone can, and he's on your side.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So some will wonder, and maybe you've wondered this. I've had people ask me this. Why didn't John, or really the Holy Spirit, why didn't they just say it? Kind of reminded me of the complaint some of Jesus' enemies had about his parables.
Yeah, just say it plainly.
Why is he teaching in parables? Why didn't he just tell us? And I wonder if some people read Revelation, I think, why didn't Jesus just come out and say it? Hey, you're being persecuted by this terrible government forces, and I'm going to intervene and rescue you, and you're all going to be okay. You'll be victorious in the end.
Right.
Why all this weird beast and imagery and figures? Why not just say it plainly?
Well, for one thing, it was a style they were used to. I mean, remember, they don't have movies. It's kind of like if an ancient person came today and watched one of our movies, they'd say, why does this scene last 20 minutes? it is what it is, man. It was their world. It was their ancient version of a movie, in one sense. It was their way of visualizing. It was their way of communicating that there's something way bigger than what you're used to is going on, way more powerful than Jerusalem or Rome or anybody else. It was a way of making the unseen realm, which is beyond our comprehension without having seen it, visible to us in a way that we can identify with. Not because literally Satan is literally a dragon, but because that's enough to get across the point that he's really nasty, really dangerous, and you can't handle him. But again, God's on your side about this. And so it was a way of making it vivid, making it real. It was a way of bringing in the imagination and the emotions as well, and really connecting in the same way that most of us really, what really connects with us is a well-wrought movie. We now literally can see these things, make our own visions, if you will. And so that's what God was doing in the ancient world. And again, and it wasn't new to them. Daniel's got it. Zechariah's got it. Ezekiel's got it.
That's the point that I think is so important.
Yeah, it's not unique.
Is I think we only ask that question because we are unfamiliar with apocalyptic style.
Correct.
But especially the Jewish audience of that age would not have been unfamiliar, and they would recognize it in the context of being persecuted and suffering.
Right.
And the apocalyptic style was very common to write and give comfort to people going through that.
Yes. So it starts in the Bible, and then they literally write their own. They write their own in imitation of the Bible.
It would be sort of like, you know, a wife being unhappy if her husband was trying to communicate love and he wrote her a poem. Would that be okay, ladies? If he wrote you, even if it was a bad poem, you wouldn't look at this and say, well, okay, why did you try to write poetry? Why didn't you just make a bullet list like you're ordering stuff from Walmart? We wouldn't ask a question like that because we understand poetry is the language used to communicate love. It's the style that goes with the moment. Nobody reads Psalms and says, well, why didn't Psalms just list, here's 8 reasons to praise God. Why do you have to have all this imagery and figures used in the book of Psalms? We understand that poetry is a great way to communicate our feelings about praise. And so just understand, we're unfamiliar with the fact that apocalyptic style was very common to communicate our fear and frustration with the terrible opposition we're facing and the desire to have God come and rescue us.
Right. And again, emotionally connect with the people and channel their fear into images that also give them hope.
With style that suited the occasion.
Absolutely.
So one more thing. I'm watching the clock up there. I don't know where our time goes. I start out, I think we have all this time, and all of a sudden we're about to get done. We have a third thing we need to talk about, and that is to understand the book correctly, going back to chapter 1, I think you've got to recognize that this book had a group of spectators, just like people who come to watch a play. There is an audience that the performers are trying to communicate to. And so when John starts writing these visions, I think key to understanding them is recognizing that he has an audience that is watching as this divine drama begins to unfold. And so we've actually already alluded to it in verse 9, right?
Right.
There's someone out there that he describes as fellow partakers in the tribulation, in the kingdom, and in the perseverance. But he actually uses that funnel style, the way we were taught to write an introduction in
right.
high school class and in writing class. You know, you start out very broad. In verse 1, it's the bondservants,
right,
which would be anyone who's serving Jesus. And then he narrows it in verse 4, and he said, I'm writing to the 7 churches in Asia.
Right.
And then in verse 11, he specifies which churches he has in
right.
mind.
And what he does is he puts them into the big story of the universe. Your life has meaning, your suffering has meaning, because you're part of something really big. It's kind of like in Star Wars when Luke Skywalker finds out he's not just a farm boy on a desert planet, he's actually son of the galactic overlord who's got to choose between right and wrong. You know, it's kind of that moment for them to have the veil pulled back and say, hey guys, you're part of something way bigger than what you realize.
And so when we work the book,
right,
I think we need to think about that group of spectators. And frankly, it's the same way we would approach any other book.
Right.
We don't pick up Ephesians and say, I wonder what Paul was saying to me when he wrote this letter. Y'all see what's backward about that, right? Because Ephesians wasn't written to me. Ephesians was written to Ephesians. And the only way to properly understand the book is to first ask, what's Paul trying to say to this group of disciples? And when we understand that,
right,
you can go back and say, okay, now, what does it mean to me? I think you have to do that revelation too.
Sure, that's right. Yeah, it's not going to be some, you know, Bible code for the year 20, you know, whatever, you know, with the true second coming of Jesus that only was relevant to, you know, at the very end. It's relevant for them.
I would argue that anybody who takes the visions of this book and interprets them in a way that would make them utterly meaningless to the spectators watching this, that they're just going down the wrong path. That's
right.
A flawed approach to the book.
Right.
You got to begin with what it would have meant to them, and then by application, figure out what it means to us.
That's right.
So think about the setting that they were in. Think about the style of the literature being employed. And then thirdly, think about this audience. And as we work with the imagery, figure out what it would have meant to them. But having said that, So how about we talk a little bit about
so
what it would mean? What's that?
So what?
Yeah. So what it would mean to all of us. So one of the reasons that Jeff and I wanted to talk about Revelation is because we both feel that increasingly we're all going to find that this is a book very relevant to us and to our times. I've wondered if that's why we've struggled with it in the past, because we just couldn't relate to it.
Yeah, couldn't. We can't see ourselves in that kind of a story because our lives are too comfortable in a culture that was Judeo-Christian.
I'm not denying that we haven't done our own struggle with the adversary.
Right.
But the war with the adversary has certainly looked different.
He wasn't using the beasts like he is in Revelation to go after us.
Well, so all of us, well, I think most all of us, have grown up in a country where men with guns protect our right to shout from the rooftops that Jesus is the Lord. And if we've had to deal with any opposition, I mean, what's the worst thing you've suffered for your faith? I had a guy laugh at me one time.
For what?
We were talking about instrumental music, and he kind of snickered and said, I really can't believe you think there's anything wrong with
that. Yeah.
And I have to honestly tell you, that's about as bad as it's ever gotten. I've had somebody laugh at me.
Right.
I've never been arrested, never had any threats of physical violence. And the truth of the matter is that that most of us have had it that way. And so did our parents and our grandparents. For literally decades and decades and decades, we've lived in a country that's given us freedom to do our thing for the Lord pretty much unchallenged.
And a Supreme Court that has undergirded it when it's come before it.
But times are changing.
Rapidly.
So I'm not dark, Jeff, right? And talking to Jeff makes me uncomfortable.
But
in part because you know what I'm going to say, right?
I want you to say it, though.
You want me to say it? Because when Jeff talks about our culture in decline, there's truth to that, isn't there? So I only let him stay in my office for a little while, and then
and then you come over to mine and make fun of me.
I don't ever go in your office. Just last week, Brandon, you sent the link to us about the statistic. Church membership in America, for the first time in the history of keeping numbers, in the last survey, dropped below 50%. Now, more Americans do not identify as being a member of a church as do identify.
Right. Which I think, you know, really isn't any surprise to any of us, because most of us recognize when you drive to services on Sunday morning, more and more the world's going on as it always has.
Easiest time to get down Louetta.
Absolutely.
Sunday morning.
People sleeping in or getting donuts.
And so what's the big deal about that? It's a symptom.
Yeah, church attendance is never the thing itself, is it? It's always a barometer of other more serious things.
And so what is it a symptom of?
We don't believe in God. I mean, you know, we can, you know, people can say they believe in God, but, you know, and those poll numbers, I mean, obviously those numbers are going down too, but still a lot of people say they believe in God. But if you don't fear God enough to change how you're living, you don't believe in him. It's just an intellectual idea. I mean, you're back to the James 2 territory, right? Even the demons believe and tremble. They know he exists, but if you're not going to change how you're living, you're functionally an atheist. And the fact of the matter is we don't fear God. We think God is a nice grandfather in the sky, and unless you're Adolf Hitler, you get to go to heaven in the end somehow, some way, because you're not that bad. We don't fear God.
I think sometimes because we operate in our bubble of brethren, that we don't have a sense of what's happening in the culture. So do y'all remember back when the Supreme Court passed the decision that sanctioned gay marriage? Do you remember that? And do you remember how many disciples were surprised? Were you surprised? Jeff wasn't surprised. Jeff told me that. Why would you be surprised at him? Why shouldn't we have been surprised?
Oh, because the culture's been setting us up for that for decades.
Yes, the decline has been going on for a long time, and that's the thing that I don't think we always see kind of operating in our bubble, the dramatic cultural shifts,
right,
that the numbers represent. Like now, more than half of the people in the country no longer identify,
right,
as being members of the church. If you start digging into numbers like that, you see the shift. Look at people under the age of 30, folks, and what they believe about God and the Bible and how the world began and those,
right,
kinds of things. And the truth is that unbelief among young people
is, well, break that, you know, you used that stat of a minute ago from the Gallup poll this week of the 50% or give or take. But the point is, when you break that out by age cohort, it's not even.
No.
And the young, to your point, under 30, it's skyrocketing. I mean, most of the decline in church membership is coming from the fact that as these kids are becoming adults, this next generation does not believe in God, does not believe in religion. They may be spiritual but not religious, but they simply do not believe in the God of the Bible.
Yeah. The other thing that corresponds to that is also on the rise, and that is less and less tolerance for what Christians believe.
Which naturally goes with the decline.
Well, it makes sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, absolutely.
So have you guys been picking up on that too? Less and less tolerance for things that disciples believe. In fact, there are some in our culture who would like to take the things you have heard said from this pulpit and label them as hate speech.
Yeah.
And describe it as a form of violence.
Right.
And criminalize it.
Well, and to your point, David, even going back to the 2015 gay marriage decision come from the Supreme Court, just to understand where this is going, don't be surprised. And by the way, that's what Peter told us in 1 Peter 4. Don't be surprised. Be real about the world you're living in. The government lawyer who is arguing in favor of it is asked by one of the Supreme Court justices in the exchange back and forth. The Supreme Court justice asked, isn't this right to gay marriage going to lead to some conflicts with religious liberty? And the government lawyer said, yeah, that's going to be an issue. Flat out, put it on the table right there in the chamber of the Supreme Court. Absolutely, this is going to lead to some conflicts, some First Amendment conflicts with the nature of religious and limits and bigger government limits on religious liberty than what we've seen before, in the name of this new right to gay marriage. So it's already, folks, it's there if we have eyes to see it, or we can put our heads in the sand and pretend it's all going to go on the way it always has. This book's going to become more and more relevant to us, isn't it?
Well, yeah,
that's our point.
I wanted to ask you. See, y'all see why I only let him stay in my office so long, because I can only do the dark for so long, and then I got to move on. But because it's scary, isn't it? And how many of you found yourself feeling that way over last 10 or 20 years, afraid for what may be coming for God's people?
And you feel like you don't know the world anymore. It's, yeah, not the world you knew.
And I think about, and those of you who are in my age or older, how many of you thought about your children and your grandchildren? I've got a little 4-year-old granddaughter, most adorable grandchild on the planet. And I think about what life is going to be like for her when she's an old woman, after the way things have changed during my little brief stint here on the planet. So that fear, how many of you were freaked out and panicked about the outcome of the election? Couldn't sleep that night, or whenever it finally ended. So here's the point about that. Revelation, brothers and sisters, is speaking to times like these. What did we say it was all about? It's a message of comfort and hope for people facing a hostile word. So,
with a call to endurance.
Yeah. Yes. I thought we would channel a little Randy Tumlinson tonight.
Yeah.
Because y'all know Randy thinks, don't let me misrepresent you. You can holler out from the back if I misrepresent you. But Randy has said that he thinks the whole book is summarized right there in that verse, chapter 17 and verse 14. I'd never thought about that before. But the more I pondered that, Randy, the more I think you're spot on. This is Revelation 17:14. These will wage war against the Lamb And the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So do you see it there? Do you see what he's saying? First of all, there's going to be this war that takes place. Adversaries of Jesus in every generation are going to go to battle against him, right?
It's every generation's battle, David.
And how's that going to turn out? Well, he's going to overcome them. Some of us need to mark that in our Bible, folks. Jesus is going to be the victor in this great struggle. And then his people get to share that victory, those who are called and chosen, and there's your endurance word.
Yep.
Faithful. Yep. And so I think Revelation does have a message of comfort and hope that allows me not to freak out with the right cultural ups and downs.
And again, to put myself into a bigger story and realize it's been Sodom, it's been Jerusalem, it's been Rome, it's been Babylon. I am part of something that the others before me have been able to overcome. It's Hebrews' cloud of witnesses. I'm part of something where others have been able to do it. I can do it too.
So I think more and more in the days that lie ahead of us, that Revelation is going to wind up being a book that won't seem so strange, but actually becomes more and more meaningful to us.
Yeah, we need the hope and we need the warning. We need both of the things the book offers.
And oddly enough, in this great book that deals with this, it winds up being the book we understand least.
Right.
Ironically. I thought about that. You know, the Song of Solomon is sort of the biblical book that addresses sex. And oddly enough, in this day where everyone's talking about sex, we don't know anything about the Song of Solomon.
Right.
It may be the hardest book in the Bible. Some people think that.
Oh, I agree with that.
So Jeff and I can't talk about the Song of Solomon because we don't agree about it. We're working on that. but now we get to Revelation. And so we have this ordeal that is facing our culture.
Right.
And the thing that God gave us to help us, to help our kids, winds up being in this book that we've turned back
from. Right. But we can do better.
Well, we need to. We need to. So carry Revelation 17:14 home with you. Maybe that needs to find its way to the screen on the monitor or the magnet on the fridge. But as we face an increasingly hostile world, brothers and sisters, we need to carry away the comfort and hope the book gives. That, yes, there's going to be a battle and Jesus is going to win it. And if we are faithful to him, we get to share the victory too. Let that give you comfort and peace as we, well, potentially face some difficult days. You got a last word on that?
I think that's a good place to put a peg.
A good place to stop. Next week.
Oh, Psalm 73.
Psalm 73. We actually had a great debate about whether or not we covered that in our Psalms class. And
don't give them that hint. They'll go back and look now.
Well, yeah. Go back and tell us that we did. I don't think we did. So we're going to talk a little bit about Psalm 73. By the way, great psalm with a great message for our time as well. Let's pray together, and that'll wrap our class up for tonight. Father, we're so grateful that through this great book, you've given us hope and comfort, even as we at times in our culture pass through difficult and adverse and challenging situations. And so may we not neglect the great message of this book, but dig deeply and search it and grasp what you were trying to say. And we pray you'd take comfort in it. We would take comfort in it as we press on in the face of the challenges our culture puts before us. Maybe we'd be faithful to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.